Now it is my pleasure to introduce Alex. I have gotten to know her slowly. She is one of these that, you know, I notice what they share, and she has some of these little insights or nuggets of knowledge that I'm like, huh, okay. Alex, come on up. I can't wait to hear your story.
My name is Alex, and I am an alcoholic. To get the formalities out of the way, I am 47 years old. My date of sobriety is 8/31/2012. I have a sponsor, all that. Being asked to tell my story is difficult in some ways. Number one, it makes me really reflect on my life in sobriety, as well as what it was like before. And a lot of those memories are really painful. And so over the past 2 months, because Kat, you asked me, what, 2 months ago? Yeah, that's a lot of time. It's a lot of time to think. But I do have a 48-hour rule, so if you want me to do service at your meeting, give me 48 hours. Some of the memories are painful, and it's painful to talk about. Being up here is vulnerable, right? And the other thing, too, is that, you know, I really, really want you to like me, okay? But there's a lot about my story that isn't necessarily likable because I am an alcoholic, and that's how I roll. I'm not auditioning for a roving speaker position. I'm just up here sharing what my life was like, what happened, and what it's like now. For those of you who think it's okay to come up to me afterwards and say, can I just give a little suggestion? I'm telling you now, the answer is no. All right, so now that we have that out of the way, I would like to do what Homer did before writing the Odyssey and invoking the muse. I'm going to invoke my higher power, that my higher power gives me the words that I need to say, because I have a lot that has happened in my life, and I think some things are really important, but I want my higher power to speak through me. And to definitely hold my tongue with the profanity, because I pepper my speech constantly. Anyone who knows me knows this. I lived abroad with a bunch of Irish, Welsh, and Kiwis for a very long time. They're not very nice in how they speak. And that people who need to hear my story hear it. Because the AA that was given to me where I got sober was not the idea of shut up, take the cotton out of your ears and put it into your mouth. The A that was given to me was speak until you can listen, listen until you can hear. And so my prayer is that the people that need to hear will hear, because I'm not for everyone and I shouldn't be. There are stories in the back of our big book that I have read numerous times, and they have no underlines or highlights in them because I just don't relate. And that's okay. Not everything is about me, but this is my story, so it is about me. I was the firstborn child of my parents. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. I had a really wonderful childhood from birth until, oh gosh, I would say about age 6. The first 4 years of my life were pretty much spent in Nashville, and I have fabulous memories. I mean, there was so much love. I had a wonderful Jewish woman that took care of me, Mizzy Black. I never knew anything but adoration from my parents. When I was about 3 and a half, my family relocated from Nashville to New Orleans. And I went to go live with my aunt and uncle and cousin in Mobile, Alabama for about 6 months, because my mother needed to start her job in New Orleans and my father was doing some sort of training in Virginia for a while. And so my aunt, who is just a wonderful woman, said, I will take her. We love her. She can stay as long as she needs to. And so I stayed with my aunt. And in my aunt's home, I never knew anything but love as well. I was absolutely adored. I do not remember a spanking. I only remember my cousin getting angry at me once, and that was because she told me she was going to take me to Bel Air Mall after she finished with school. I got into her makeup to make myself look real pretty, but I got it all over the furniture, and she was really pissed off about that and wouldn't take me to the mall that day. So I can say that that was the worst thing that was happening, okay? And once I got to New Orleans after living with my aunt, my younger sister was born. Unbeknownst to me at the time, this was actually my second youngest sister. I did have an Irish twin who died 2 days after birth. We're so happy to be back with my family, and I thought the problems when I was a little kid were because of my sister. This bizotch has the audacity to be born, and, you know, now I have to share attention. But there was another visitor that came to my house, and that visitor was my parents' alcoholism. I know that losing, I've seen friends and heard in meetings of people that lose children, and it's a devastating loss. And so I look back now from a different perspective of one of compassion for both of my parents having to endure that. But they did start drinking a lot. Alcohol was just a part of life in New Orleans anyway. I mean, this is a city where we were aghast when the city council dared to not allow people to drink during city council meetings. I mean, how dare they? My mother's office at the bank had a bar in it. I was accustomed to alcohol everywhere, and the drinking age in the 80s was 18 anyway, so it was not unheard of to see somebody walking across campus on senior day at the school that I went to holding a beer. Nobody cared. There was a smoking room on campus. You know, things were just very, very different, and it was part of my life, and I knew that when I grew up I would probably drink and smoke. I just didn't realize how much, but that was what adults did. And I noticed that my dad became louder and angrier, and my mother in her alcoholism became very, very withdrawn and isolated. There is physical abuse in my story. My sister was scapegoated. It was not a happy house to live in. My childhood was mostly very, very unhappy from about age 6 onward. I mean, just deep unhappiness, just feeling that nobody understood me, nothing was ever good enough, because the goalposts always changed. And as an adult now, having had many a hangover, I get it. You get hung over. I get hung over. Something that didn't annoy me yesterday is going to annoy the hell out of me today, because I really have a hangover. It just was walking on eggshells. I was really unhappy and in a lot of pain. It just was rough. You know, it's not easy growing up in a home with two active alcoholics. And as my father got angrier, my mother retreated more. The bottled wine turned into box wine. The whiskey sours, and I know they were whiskey sours because guess who went to K&B to get the sour mix? I did. Turned into scotch on the rocks with water and then without water. By the time I got to high school and I realized that I wasn't exactly straight, I really felt out of place. When I was a freshman in high school, I got drunk for the first time, and I did it on gin because it was in the liquor cabinet, and I knew that nobody would notice because it still had the Tennessee liquor license tax stamp on it, which meant that my parents hadn't touched it since the 70s. And so I drank and drank and drank with a friend. And I didn't feel anything for 45 minutes to an hour. And I thought, well, this is the oddest thing. What the hell is this about? Oh, and then it hit me. And I made an idiot out of myself. I had a friend spending the night that night. And I was just rambunctious. I was bouncing off the walls. And then after about an hour, I crashed and just started crying hysterically to where I could not stop. And my friend was like, I don't know what I got in you. I'm not spending the night at your house again. And I woke up the next morning, no hangover, and I thought, I don't ever want to do that again. So about a month later, I went to a party, and they had, I want to say it was like Milwaukee's Best Light, some sort of, you know, high school beer crap like that. And I had a couple of those, and the exact same thing happened. I ran around like a banshee, making a jerk out of myself, and then went home with, I think, that same friend who was foolish enough to spend the night with me again, where my mother greeted me at the door, and she looked at me and she said, I know you're on something. And I immediately burst into tears, went back into a deep depression, told her I got drunk, please don't tell Dad, I'll never do it again. And I didn't for about a year. And then I drank scotch. And my parents' friends were in town from Spain. I don't have much of a memory of that meal. It just sort of was a brownout. And my dad pulled me aside the next day and said, look, I know you were on something last night. And we don't need to get into it because you're young and you're going to do what you're going to do, but I do want to let you know that substance abuse runs in both sides of your family. And you may want to consider not participating in the high school drinking culture here in New Orleans. I wound up moving to Texas. In Texas, I didn't have any friends. I was living with my mother. My parents had divorced by that time, and my mother was drinking at night. I don't know how. I'm still trying to remember the exact conversation. But, because I didn't have any friends and I was so lonely, I was able to guilt trip her into getting me a handle of vodka so that I could drink at night like she did. And she got me Taka vodka. Do y'all know what Taka vodka is? Ooh, it is gut rot. I mean, thanks for spending the money. I should have at least gotten Absolut, but, okay. I mean, maybe she thought that by giving me paint thinner that I wouldn't have liked it. I don't know, because, booze is booze is booze, but bless her. So I started drinking every night, and at the end of my junior year, my grades had plummeted. I started going to AA, as well as a program in Houston that was called PDAP. And I think I strung together maybe a couple of months of sobriety, but soon just got bored with it. I started making friends at school who were occasionally drinking, and I, dropped it. And then a year later, at the end of my senior year of high school, I went on a binge, and I drank every night probably for about 3 weeks because at that point in time, I started to have symptoms of a mental illness called OCD. And OCD is not characterized by someone wanting to, oh, I have to put these chips exactly so. But it's characterized by intrusive thoughts into your head that you cannot control, I could not control, that are often very shocking in nature, and that someone will create a ritual to try to ameliorate how they felt. I didn't have the internet back then, so there was no Googling symptoms. Dr. Google didn't exist. But Dr. Bottle did. And when I drank, my brain calmed down. And after about 3 weeks of binge drinking and, having just an awful existence, I went to AA for the second time. And that was the summer before I went to college. And stuck around, went to meetings. Spring Branch Memorial Club was a wonderful place because you could smoke inside. It's back in the days when you could smoke inside. Once I got to college, I dropped AA because I got a girlfriend. Broke up with the girlfriend, traded the girlfriend in for fundamentalist religion, and spent the next 4 years trying to pray away being gay. Doesn't work. But I have to say that the ism was always there. And the ism for me during that time manifested itself in being incredibly judgmental, sanctimonious, unpleasant, and angry. I started getting really, really angry and hating people and hating the world. And after I graduated from college, my mother died. And it was very, very shocking. She had a stroke and died 10 days later. She should have passed when she went into a coma, but the doctor in Alabama, in his infinite wisdom, decided to toss aside her medical directive and revive her. And she lingered in a really awful state for about 7 days. And I didn't find that out until many, many years later, and I'm really glad I didn't find it out because I'd be in the Alabama State Penitentiary waiting to be executed. When my mother died, I went back to my aunt's house because we were in Mobile at this point in time, and I looked out over the creek across the street from where she lived, and I thought, I guess my mother's burning in hell. And I don't think I really want to be a part of this religion anymore. And 6 months later, when the grief really started hitting me, because the first 6 months I could sort of rationalize her being away. It was sort of like being away for a semester at college. The pain that came was unlike anything I had ever felt up until that point in time. And the only thing that I knew that would take it away was alcohol. And so I started drinking. And I moved back to Texas, and I drank, my way through graduate school. I destroyed many friendships. alienated professors. I was highly inappropriate. Like, y'all, I'm just going to say this, but, like, you can't grope people anymore. Like, they don't roll that way out there anymore. Okay, like, in the 90s and early 2000s, you could get away with doing that at bars, pinching some butts and boobs and stuff. They don't do that anymore. You will go to jail. And that was the type of behavior that I was engaging in. And I look back on it now, and I'm like, oh, girl. You know, but it was what it was. And I wound up staying in Austin working odd jobs for a couple of years just to stay with my friends. But I was really there because I wanted to drink. And I wound up moving to South Korea in 2009 because an upstairs neighbor of mine had said, you know, go give it a try. It's a different flavor. You've lived in Europe before. Go ahead and try it. And so I did. 3 months later, I sold everything that I had, and I was in Korea. And I want to be clear that it was not a geographic, because I had no designs on quitting drinking. But I didn't drink for the first month that I was there just because I didn't really know the drinking culture, and it was, you know, it's a strange place, and I needed to figure things out. And I didn't want to drink alone, because to me, to drink alone was to be an alcoholic. That's what my mother did. Honey, Asia is heaven alcoholics. I mean, you can pass out in a bar. They don't care. And when you wake up, they will serve you. Okay? You can chain smoke, because I always like to bring like 4 packs of cigarettes out with me, because, whew, I never met a cigarette I didn't love. And because I was bumming to people, you know. And cigarette packs were $2 there. I mean, it was like 1993 all over again. I was in heaven. And I my drinking just took off, and it was fabulous. Because I didn't have any cultural restraint on me anymore. They did a study saying that Koreans drank more than anybody in the world because they took like something like 13 shots a night. And I'm here to let you know that's baloney, because they black out and forget the other 10. And so I was with my people, and I am convinced that if I had stayed in the States, my act of alcoholism might have lasted another 10 years if I had been lucky. But in Korea, I was able to cram into a very short amount of time a lot of booze. I wouldn't leave the country on vacation, really, because I wanted to go to my pub. I didn't want to not be with my pub friends, and I just kept drinking. And I decided, I was a competitive weightlifter at the same time. And one fall of 2011, I thought, you know what, I'm going to stop drinking because I really want to focus on my training. You see what I'm doing here. I'm substituting exercise in for booze. And I did. And 2 months into not drinking, a friend of mine from my rugby team invited me to her birthday party at a pub. Because there are no restaurants, we don't have restaurants in Korea. It's like you go to a convenience store to drink. It's fabulous. Go inside, get a bag of chips, make some ramen, keep drinking. They wouldn't kick you out. Use the bathroom in the alleyway. That's the way it was. I mean, it was great. And, for active alcoholics, I'm telling you, it's Pleasure Island. I wanted to go to this party because I wanted to be there for my friend's birthday. But I knew that if I went to that party, I wouldn't be able to socialize with anybody because I couldn't talk to people without a little bit of booze. And I knew that if I had one drink, I was going to have 10, and I was going to break the commitment that I had made to myself to not drink that fall for my training and my competition. And I wound up having a breakdown on my floor. And I reached out to a good friend of mine from graduate school in Texas, and gosh, did she know how I drank. And she said to me, Alex, it's okay to ask for help and go to AA if you need to. It's okay. One of my best friends went to AA, and it changed his life, and he's been sober for 20 years. And it's okay. I'm not going to judge you. So I went to AA in Korea, and I hated it. I just hated it. I didn't want to be there. Didn't like the people there. Didn't like the program. I was rageful. I was angry. I did get a sponsor. I did try to work a step or two. But the problem was that I was doing work for step one. I was doing what my sponsor told me. I was writing. But I hadn't had I hadn't taken that step here. I was just writing. It was just an exercise. And so on Christmas Eve of 2011, I checked in with my sponsor, and then I went out with my rugby team. And I don't understand slips. Why would you want to slip? I did a Greg Louganis dive back into full-blown alcoholism, humping people in the bar, totally wasted and totally incredibly joyful to be back with my lover booze. There was none of this, like, head full of AA, and that was not an issue for me because my alcoholism didn't care about AA. And I also liked a woman on my rugby team, and I thought, you know, if I can get into a relationship, that's gonna fix me. And I got into a relationship. It was horrible. I never even really liked the girl, but I got attached to her, as you do. She wound up moving to Korea for a little bit to be with me. My drinking did taper off, so check that box. But I would wake up next to her, and I would look at her, and I was like, I can't stand you. I hate how you look. I hate how you smell. But God, please don't leave me, because I think I'll commit suicide if you go. Can anyone relate? She left Korea, and I knew it was over, and so I went on another binge. And the last night that I got drunk, I started out at trivia. No. I got ribs because it had two free beers came with the ribs. Got the ribs, went with my Kiwi friend to trivia. We won trivia that night, so we got a bunch of free beer. They give you like the equivalent of a $60 gift certificate. That buys a lot of pitchers. Then after that, we went to the convenience store on the main road near kind of where both of our places were. And I drank probably from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4 or 5 o'clock, until maybe 2 or 3 in the morning, and I could not get drunk. I could not get drunk. I did not feel a thing. And I felt like a cannonball had gone through my solar plexus. And I, you know, at one point I was crying, and my friend was trying to pick me up and make me happy. And I had hiccups at one point, so I know that if you had taken my blood, I would have popped a really high blood alcohol content, but I didn't feel a thing, nothing. And when I woke up the next morning, I that was my bottom. And we didn't have air conditioning, and Korean summers are much like Atlanta summers, but a lot of homes don't have AC in them. And I just sat there drinking water and in the dark, with a fan blowing on me, contemplating, you know, what am I going to do? I can't do this. I know I'm going to kill myself with alcohol over the next month. I know it because I was on vacation. I went online and I looked up remote therapists and found someone in England that was £75 an hour, which I think back in those days the exchange rate was probably double, so it would have been $150 an hour. I don't have that kind of cash. Smart Recovery Group was way out at some army base. It was like a 3-hour schlep, and I wasn't doing that either. So I thought, well, screw it. I'll just go back to AA. So I contacted a friend of mine that I had stayed in touch with, and I said, Juan, are you still going to meetings? He said, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to one this Friday. I said, can we please meet? Can you take me to the meeting? I can't do this anymore. I just can't. And he said, yeah, let's meet at Holly's Coffee. So for the next 3 days, all I did was drink water and sit in that dark room, and a lot of tears, a lot of anger, a lot of contemplation, but I just had the sense of, I can't. I'm powerless, and at that point, I really understood unmanageability. Because I was willing to drink myself to death over a woman I couldn't stand. And so I went to Korean AA, and I was not happy to be there. Not like people. And there, you know, thank God, there's no 90 and 90 in Korea. In a city of 22 million people, back then, there were 8 meetings a week. And you either made the meeting or you didn't. And in Korea, you don't go up to your boss and say, I'm in recovery, I need to be let off early to go to such and such meeting. They'll be like, oh, you're an alcoholic. Visa denied. I went to meetings when I could, and I met my sponsor, Bonnie. I met her in a Big Book meeting that she chaired, and she's British, kind of wavy. Nobody that I ever would have been friends with while I was drinking, But I noticed something about her that she would share about her life and her problems. But she would always talk about how AA was helping her through. And I thought, you know, that's really interesting. And so she wound up leaving the country, and on a whim, she just said, look, here's my email address. I don't know when I'll be back to Korea, but, you know, let me know if you ever need anything. I'm happy to be of service. And so about a month later, after I had broken up with my ex and I didn't drink, I got in touch with her and I said, I need a sponsor. Because there weren't a lot of women in the program. And I know that here in the States, there's this ethos of women with women. I couldn't have done women with women. I needed men. I needed safe men. Because after that relationship, I was hopeful for women. And I needed to be around men. I'm a lesbian. I like to sleep with women. And the men that were there were safe. And they were good and kind and nurturing. And it took me a while to open up to them. You know, I'm not the warmest, friendliest fruit on the vine. But these men were safe for me. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm convinced that my higher power put me in that position. That was my divine appointment. That was the door. And I don't want to mess with that. So I take my recovery very, very seriously. And in Korea, we would end with the serenity prayer. You know, because of the time that I spent trying to pray away the gay, I don't know that I could have stayed in meetings with the Lord's Prayer. Because to me, it was linked with something that was very traumatic for me of trying to pray away my sexuality. And, you know, and that's just me. And I came in atheist, came in a very combative atheist. And because Korea is a country that has a lot of atheists and also a lot of Buddhists, I was at home in the meetings there because it was all right. Okay, you know, it's your business. And so when Bonnie started sponsoring me, she gave me a couple of conditions. She said, you know, we're going to have to work over Skype because I'm not in Korea. I said, I don't care. She said, we're going to use the big book. And I think her exact quote was, and in this wonderful Julie Andrews voice, I'm sure the 12 and 12 is a wonderful philosophic contemplation of the 12 steps, but the big book is the manual for working them. I said, that's fine. I hate the 12 and 12. She said, you need to get a service position immediately, non-negotiable. I was like, ooh. Okay. And she said, and you need to go to 3 meetings a week, and you need to be honest with yourself if you need more. And I was like, oh, thank God, no 90 and 90, thank God. And we started, and she read through the big book with me. And one time over Skype, she heard me highlighting something, and she said, excuse me, what are you doing? I said, I'm highlighting this. I think it's important. She says, honey, you don't know what's important. I'm going to tell you what's important, and I'm going to tell you what to write down, and we're going to discuss it, but don't assume that you know anything about this process because you don't. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's why you're mentoring me through this. Okay. Well, the first 3 steps in a lot of senses were a done deal when I came back into the rooms. I understood. I had taken the first step. Bonnie had me write out what I wanted my higher power to be. I wanted Santa Claus. She said, honey, that's not going to work. I said, oh, no, 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 girl, you don't get to tell me that. I did the assignment. Why would I not want Santa Claus? She said, I can see this is a problem. I said, I told you that before you made me waste the ink. And she said, why don't we try this? Why don't we just add an O to the word God? And you get in touch with the good. Okay, what is good to you? And I got combative. I was like, well, good in certain cultures is bad for me. I don't care what certain cultures think. What is good for you? And I said, well, good is sober. And she said, let's start there. Every morning you will turn your consciousness towards good. Can you do that? Yes. Are you willing to turn your will in your life over to good as you understand it? Hell yes. Great. We'll start on your inventory the next time we speak. And I loved the inventory, even though it was the most painful thing I had ever done in my life. Because for the first time in my life, I was allowed to say, I am not just angry, I'm enraged. Because growing up, little girls don't give lip. Good Southern girls don't get angry. They shut up. And everything started pouring out of me. It was like I had lanced a carbuncle over my heart. And I just thought, you know what? No, I was pissed about that. I was angry. How dare you? And I went column through that resentment inventory and got to get really real about what I hated, what I resented. I had everybody on that thing. I went through my fears in the same way. I mean, there was some weird shit on my fears, sorry. Like, I was afraid that if I got too close to the ledge on a balcony that I was going to jump off. Probably part of my OCD, but I put that on my inventory. Didn't really have a lot of sex inventory, but, you know, that's a blessing I hear. And I read it to Bonnie over Skype, and it took about 5 weeks, maybe 3 to 4 hours a week to go through it. And during it, you know, I was so depressed. And so she's like, you're not supposed to be happy during this process. You're looking at your darkness. You're looking at how you hurt people. You're not supposed to feel good, my friend. And I realized during that time that I was really going into something that I didn't know existed inside of me. I didn't feel free after my fifth step. I felt raw, probably for a month. And I remember asking Bonnie, like, okay, when are these promises coming true? Like, because I'm not feeling it. And she's like, just wait. And I took the hour, like she said, and I'm writing down all these things, and I'm following the directions in the book because I got to Skype the woman back, and I'm writing down what my character defects are and this, that, and the other. And we get back on Skype, and she says, okay, what'd you do? Did you do the hour? Did you find any, like, chinks in the armor that we need to talk about? And I said, well, I wrote down all my character defects. And she said, oh, you did? Okay. You want to read them to me? And I kind of knew by her tone that she was kind of not happy with me. And so I started reading, and she said, I need to stop you right there. She said, I've just spent a month and a half listening to all of your crappy behavior. I don't have another minute for it. Your character defects are that you are selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, inconsiderate, and frightened. Everything else is poor behavior. This is what underlies the poor behavior. How's it working for you? It's not. Do you want it removed? Yes. Then hit your knees, say the seventh-step prayer, and we'll Skype tomorrow to start your eight-step list. Went through the eighth step. I had this, by this time it was summer 2013, and I had this idea that I was going to go to Thailand, to an island, and do MMA. I never wanted to go to Thailand before in my life because I saw this movie called Broke Down Palace about people getting arrested there. And I don't give a lick about MMA. I think it's kind of gross. But that was my idea. And she said, or you can go back to the States and make amends. I said, yeah, I could do that. Yeah. So I flew my ass back, and I went around on my grand tour of 1, 2, 3, 4 states. Oh, goodness. And I made face-to-face amends with a lot of the people that were on my list. And some people accepted them. Some people didn't. But what Bonnie told me was, it doesn't matter if you feel that defect was removed. It doesn't matter if you think that they were worse to you than you were to them. This is a program of action. You're going to do this. Like, we're not sitting on this. There were not a lot of living amends. You need to go and have hard conversations with the people that you mauled emotionally while you were drinking. And I did it, and I started to feel free. And throughout this time, I continued to take inventory just like I had during the fourth step. I would send it to her via email. And I was meditating. I was still getting in touch with my higher power that I called good. Eventually, Bonnie said, okay, we need to go through the 12 step together. It's time that you start sponsoring. Now, honestly, that's something that I've struggled with throughout my recovery. I have never really considered myself to be an adept sponsor, but I do it because it has kept me sober. Some people like skip to doing it, and that's okay. I just wasn't one of those people. I never wanted kids. Wait, I'm a selfish alcoholic. But what Bonnie told me was, like, I took time out of my life to give this to you. Shut the hell up and give it to others. This program doesn't care if you don't like it. It still works. It's a program of the feet, not of the head. And so I have. It's been a wild ride. I do want to briefly say that, you know what, for 6.5 years, I despised AA meetings. I would hold my nose when I came into them because I could not separate my crap from yours. And I realized that about 6 years sober, and there are people in the room who knew me during that time, that I had to figure out a way to stay in the rooms. You know, I'm ticking the boxes. I'm doing everything. And I love my sober life, and my family is regenerate, you know. But meetings were really a struggle. But then I went to our sister program, and because I felt the tap on my shoulder, deal with this outside issue. And I did it. And I also went to a home meeting where I really got to know some old-timers and to see them humanized, not just a preacher in the corner giving a lecture, but somebody who has their own struggles. And those two things together kept me in the rooms. Because I wouldn't be here now without them. On any given day, I'm still an agnostic. I can still be an atheist. Although now I don't have a problem referring to God as that unknown thing. I personally, my experience is not that, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, but I had to work my natural ass off to get it. This is because I've seen people stop and they go back out. So there is personal effort that has to be expended. And I needed all of my relapses to get to a place of surrender. And as painful as they were and as much damage that they wrought in my life, I'm grateful for them because that's what brought me to a place where I knew I had conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and my life was unmanageable. And that catapulted me into the steps as an atheist. And staying here got me into a place where things have shape-shifted, things have changed. You know, I still struggle with people. I'm not the biggest people person. Shocker. But I'm a lot better than I was, and that's progress for me. I'm better with boundaries. I'm better with my family. You know, I took care of my 7-year-old nephew for my sister while she was relocating from California, and that was such a privilege. Because I got to give to him what my aunt gave to me. It came full circle. And when I think about that experience that my higher power gave me, I get goosebumps. Because like I said, I never wanted kids. But I would throw myself in front of a train for this little boy. I love my family. My dad is not going to stop drinking. The man is in his 80s, and he loves his martinis. And he can be a right SOB. But I love him, and I made an attempt to make amends with him. And even though he shut me down, I have a decent enough relationship with him now that I was sad when they relocated from Atlanta down to Florida. 15 years ago, I would have been like, bye, girl! and I have a life that's a blessing, you know. But bad stuff has happened. You know, I got a master's degree in something that I desperately cared about and that I was so excited about to go into this career. And that field has recently been absolutely gutted. There aren't any jobs. And that hurts. That hurts. It hurts because I felt that my higher power wanted me to get that degree and go into that direction. And it hurts because that was my dream. But I'm not guaranteed my dreams. What AA does guarantee me is a fulfilling life if I continue to work this program, help others, show up, and do what I need to do in order to stay sober. And that even when the crap hits the fan, when my family relocates, instead of going into a ball of, oh, I was abandoned, of being able to come in here and share my story with you, and hopefully somebody tonight was reached, that it's okay to not like AA. It's okay to not believe in God. It's okay to think that this program is the biggest load of poo and you hate being in meetings because goodness knows I had to treat them like insulin for my alcoholism. I've never met a diabetic who's orgasmic about shooting up insulin, but they do it. I continue to come. I continue to show up. I've started integrating phone calls and reaching out more into my program so I get out of my head. My head, it's for entertainment purposes only, but only if you're a masochist. So with that, I'm going to hand the meeting back to Kat. It's been a privilege to be here. Thank you for your service, and I will leave it there. Thanks, Alex. You did great.
First I slip, and then I trip to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is. Sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God wants us, we walk eternally. Take me where the promise is.